Charles Gore was born in 1853 in Wimbledon. Both his parents were aristocrats. The family had money. There was a 40-acre section. Hard to believe anybody owns 40 acres in Wimbledon now. But it was a background of privilege, education. His parents were on the Whiggish side of aristocracy. That is to say, those mildly in favour of reform, as opposed to the Tories. At the age of 8 years old, Charles Gore read a novel called Father Clement, which was an uplifting tale of a Roman Catholic priest who had made the transition and the journey from being a Roman Catholic to being a low-church Protestant, worshipping via the medium of the Bible. Inspiring tale of giving Charles Gore's background. But what struck the young Charles Gore was the bit at the front end of the novel, the descriptions of what Father Clement got up to as a Roman Catholic priest and the kind of services he led. He was entranced by what he read there, and this acted as a kind of attracting agent to a different style of religion, to that which he'd been brought up with. And precocious child that he was, he set out to track down the centres of ritualist Anglo-Catholic worship in central London. And so already by the time he was on the frontiers of leaving childhood, he had become a convinced Anglo-Catholic. Obviously, a bright spark. He was then sent to Harrow for secondary school, an unusual choice because it was a school more renowned for its sporting reputation than for its scholarship. But he was already emerging as a very bright spark there. And while he was at Harrow in his teenage years, the next second formative influence on his life emerged. Brooke Foss Westcott, then a teacher at Harrow, later to become a professor of New Testament literature at Oxbridge, and then finally the Bishop of Durham. What Westcott's famous for is the production of the Revised Standard Version of the Bible, which from memory came out in 1880. Now, this sounds like the King James Version of the Bible, but it's incredibly accurate. That's why we were told to buy it at Theological College. I must try and see if I can fool the 8 o'clockers one time and read the lessons from the Revised Version, see if they spot the difference. As I say, it just sounds exactly like the KJV, but it's just the difference is that, you know, 300 years of accompanying scholarship has improved in all sorts of ways. Well, Westcott, rather like Donald MacKinnon, you know, the famous Oxbridge German teacher who inspired Rowan Williams, was a man renowned for his lengthy prolix sermons that not everybody understood. So he seems an unlikely person to have inspired a teenage boy. But he preached a sermon in the Harrow Chapel on the need for the disciplined life. Again, a very off-putting title, the thought, for a teenager. And in this sermon, he talked about St. Anthony of Egypt and the Desert Fathers, about St. Benedict and the creation of the monastery at Monte Cassino and the Benedictines, St. Francis and his friars, St. Ignatius and the Jesuits, and then throughout the challenge, can we have a kind of avenue and a role for the ascetic life in the 19th century in the Anglican Church? And Gore remembered this, and of course this would be very important because later on he would become one of the founders of the Community of the Resurrection Murfield. More about that later. Well, Gore leaves Harrow and goes to Oxford to read classics, and while he's doing a very good degree in classics, he is devouring a great deal of patristic theology. That is to say, he's making use of his fluency in Latin and Attic Greek to devour the theologians of the first 8 centuries of the church, and has become thoroughly conversant with that. By the time he's graduated, he's a tutor in classics at one of the Oxford colleges, but of course that wasn't going to last very long, and he would be ordained soon afterwards. We might note that he was therefore a very ascetic person in his own right. He was led an intensely disciplined life, but one of his contemporaries said this: with all his moral rigorism and insistence on renunciation, we must conjoin with all that his love of good literature, his discerning taste in art, his delight in foreign travel, his fastidiousness, his appreciation of the good things, the elegances of life, even of material. Well, in these years at Oxford, he attracts a group of people around him: Henry Scott Holland, Edward S. Talbot, and J.R. Illingworth, young Anglo-Catholic intellectuals who are nicknamed the Holy Party. And they evolve a style of working that will later come together crucially in the major theological production of Charles Gore's life, the Lux Mundi collection of essays. And what they would do is they would reach out to some country veteran and say, look, summer's coming along and I'm sure you want to get away for a long break with your family. How about we come and live in your vicarage, take over the Sunday services of the church, we'll say morning and evening prayer in the church, and we'll use this as a kind of study party for the summer. So their working method was they'd get up that same morning prayer, they'd go away and do their thing in their own private area of study, and they'd come together in the evening after evening prayer, and they'd compare notes on what they'd been doing, and they'd have kind of a brains pool, a pooling of talent. And this highly effective method of working would evolve later on as they added other people, Francis Paget, R.C. Moberly, and others, to produce the famous Lux Mundi collection of essays. Well, he was ordained in 1878. He was the curate of Bootle in the Diocese of Liverpool, and then in the Liverpool church of the Reverend Bell Cox, who had been imprisoned for ritual offences. So in other words, his training vicar was somebody who had been to jail for wearing vestments and for worshipping an Anglo-Catholic style. We'll come to that in a minute. At the age of only 26, he has made the vice-principal of Cuddesdon Theological College in 1880. Here we see Cuddesdon, still probably the most thriving theological college in the Church of England today. We need to understand there were no such things as theological colleges in the Anglican world until the middle of the 19th century. Cuddesdon was the first off the block, established by Bishop Samuel Wilberforce of Oxford. Cuddesdon's actually a village not far, it's about a bus ride out of Oxford. Famous right now, since more murders happen here than anywhere else in England, because things like Midsummer Murders and all those, you know, terribly elegant BBC crime shows are filmed at Cuddesdon because it makes ideal background. And this was regarded with high suspicion. This is like Roman seminaries in the Church of England. But it survived its initial difficult years under H.P. Lydon, and here's Gore already in this prime position to be shaping and forming young vocations. Well, he wasn't there for very long, because Edward Bouverie Pusey, one of the first great founding fathers of the Oxford movement, had died about then and left his vast library and enough money to endow what would be called known as Pusey House in Oxford, which was to act as a centre of Anglo-Catholic influence in Oxford. And so Gore now becomes the first principal of Pusey House. University regarded this new institution on its front doorstep with some suspicion, and so Gore's helpers at Pusey House had to be called librarians in order to satisfy them. Well, two important things happen in these years at Pusey House. This is the chapel, by the way. Rather splendid. Probably wasn't like that right away. It took a while to get to that stage. First of all, Gore is now surrounded by the questions of the younger generation. He's aware of what the brightest minds are asking about their difficulties about Christian belief. But also he's with bright minds, back with the Holy Party. They're studying together, writing together, and working together. So in 1889, this is the young Charles Gore as he was then, comes the publication of Lux Mundi, the collection of essays that burst like a bombshell on the theological scene in England and also on Anglo-Catholicism. And I need to speak just for a couple of minutes now about where the Oxford movement had got to. In the 1830s, the 1840s and the 1850s, we have the first movement of developing Anglo-Catholicism, known as Tractarianism, because their chief means of getting their ideas out were the tracts for the times. They were written by people like John Henry Newman, Keble, Pusey, and they would distribute these monographs to every vicarage in England that would take them. And they were encouraging the Church of England to believe in itself as the Church, to recover its sense of confidence, to encourage the belief that the apostolic succession of bishops was what really mattered in terms of the leadership of the church and the continuity of the church down the generations. But if you had gone to a church where the Tractarians were the vicar, the kind of worship wouldn't have been that different. It wouldn't have been quite what we expect now. They would have worn a surplus cassock, a surplice, a black scarf, an academic hood. They might have celebrated with their back to the people. Everything would have been done decently in order. They would have used the Book of Common Prayer and none other. But the whole business of, you know, wearing vestments, coloured stoles, a more imaginative and colourful use of liturgy, often copied on Roman Catholic styles, has yet to happen. And that happens in the second phase of the movement called ritualism. Because what happened was that under the leadership of John Henry Newman, the Tractarians went picking fights in order to try and publicise their cause and oppose what they saw as undesirable developments in the Church of England. And in the end, the Oxford establishment got sick and tired of them enough to boot them out of Oxford. And really, when John Henry Newman defected to Rome in, I think, 1845, it caused just a huge shock to the movement. And what happened then is that those who'd been influenced by it kind of fanned out across the parishes of England and tended to end up in the parishes that nobody else wanted to go to in the industrial cities of Britain. And as in a way to popularise what they were doing, they began to adopt a more imaginative approach to ceremonial, ritual action and liturgy. And from this time on, that the wearing of Eucharistic vestments begin, processions, the use of incense and all the things that we now associate with the movement. And with it comes a counter-prevailing kickback from Protestant extremists and also the mainline establishment of the Church of England, many of whom see this as a betrayal of the Protestantism of the Church of England. And it's from this era that we have things like the riots in the East End of London. St George's in the East was attacked by a rioting mob several times. We have, later on, various ritualist figures being sent to prison after prosecutions by various Protestant associations. But the second movement of the Oxford movement, the ritualists, is very conservative theologically when it gets around to thinking about theology. It's certainly got no time for the advancing biblical criticism from Germany. And its conclusions is reluctant to face up to the great questions being posed by Victorian society and the advance of scientific knowledge. What Lux Multi does in this, really, it's the publication of these essays signal the third phase of the movement and the launch of what is known as liberal Catholicism, Anglo-Catholicism. It believes in the apostolic order. It believes in the threefold succession of ministry. But it is now trying to come to terms with the difficulties and questions of late Victorian scepticism. So, for instance, in the matter of biblical criticism, Gore says, okay, I accept that Moses did not write the first five books of the Bible. I'm prepared to accept the Wellhausen thesis that, you know, that the Yahwist, the Elohist, the Priestly, the Deuteronomic and, authors kind of put together what we now call Genesis. That I'm prepared to allow biblical criticism to be operative throughout the Old Testament, to accept a kind of progressive idea of revelation in the Bible. But not the New Testament, that's off limits. You know, we don't apply biblical criticism to the New Testament because what happened there, in Gore's view, was the disciples, having spent a long time with Jesus, Jesus had spent a kind of prime time getting them used to his whole thought world, they then were reliable people to write the New Testament documents. So in other words, he accepted what we would not now accept is that people like, you know, Luke really wrote Luke and Mark really wrote Mark. The other thing he did was to, people had become aware of what we call the problem of historical consciousness in Jesus. In other words, people could no longer believe, as they had in the first 1,000 years of the church, that the personality of Jesus arrived kind of ready-made from heaven. And therefore, Gore puts forward the idea of what's called kenotic Christology. Now, you'll recall that in Philippians 2, it talks about, you know, Jesus Christ emptying himself of his divine privileges, son though he was. You know, the first centuries of the church had said, oh, well, what Jesus did when he appeared to profess ignorance about the future or to be afraid, he pretended to be like that in order to look at convincing as a human being. The 19th century kenoticists had said, no, Jesus surrendered his divine privileges in becoming a human being. He became as we did. And he grew into his consciousness as the Son of God and accepted all the limitations of being a human being. Because now you see, people are aware that any human being develops slowly. and we develop through the influence of our parents, our peer group, the education system we're exposed to, our surrounding cultural and social milieu. But there was a problem about kenotic Christology, which Gore never satisfactorily solved. In fact, there were two problems. First of all, Christianity had been saying up till now that God is impassible, that is to say, he is not affected by evil. He does not allow human passions to sway him. He is beyond human vulnerability. Well, if Jesus had divested himself of all his divine privileges, then that was a hard line to take anymore, because it seemed he had been deeply affected by the vulnerabilities of being a human being. And the other, even more major problem is, of course, that in terms of the role that Jesus has within the Trinity, it is to be the governor of creation. He is the one through whom the worlds were made and who rules by divine providence over the universe. Well, he couldn't have said actually then, excuse me just a minute, Father and Holy Spirit, I'm just going to pop down to earth for 30 years as a vulnerable human being and just run the universe for me while I'm away. That clearly didn't wash. And Gore never satisfactorily got around to this. Nevertheless, canonic Christology did solve a number of problems then. But for the second phase of the movement, the ritualists, the people like H.B. Lydon, who had been his mentor and his guardian, they were appalled at this. They felt it had been a betrayal, a sellout to modern liberal principles. But what this had done, though, was to bring Anglo-Catholicism kind of into the mainstream of the Church of England. It made it extremely respectable intellectually. Young adults could now believe it. And he kind of positioned Anglo-Catholicism to begin to prepare to move on to the commanding heights of the Church of England in the following century, which I'll get around to talking about in due course. Well, he was a busy boy in these Oxford years. He gets around along with Westcott and Scott Holland to forming the Oxford branch of the Christian Social Union. This is like Westcott and his flirtation with Christian socialism, only Gore means it rather more. He'd seen a thing or two in Liverpool and was well aware of the problems of that industrial civilisation. And also in 1892, he, along with Cyril Bickersteth, John Carter, Walter Freer and George Langridge and James Nash take vows of profession at Pusey House Chapel to form the Society of the Resurrection. Now, this is one of the emergent religious orders for men in the Church of England. The Merfield Fathers, as they've come to be called, they're elusive vows in the sense that they're more ready for mission action. Now, a decade or so after this, the community moved to West Yorkshire in the north of England in order to be near the action, as they saw it, of the major problems evolving in industrial revolution England. And this is the mill owner's house that they bought there in at Merfield, which is a village between between Huddersfield and Leeds. The house at the end was built, that's the retreat house that was built more latterly. I could have wished that this photograph of the monastery church, a Walter Tapper creation created later, could have shown the outside. It's a vast aircraft hangar of a building. Just one of the hugest places I've ever worshipped in my life. I remember when we used to serve at college, we'd form up here, just out of sight, in the room's rehearsal for every high mass, and there were spots on the flagstones where you went into position as seraphim or crucifer or what have you. And here we have the thing really going up from top, the high mass being celebrated. By my time at Merfield, they take the big six candlesticks to come off the altar, and you sit there, the priests were now facing westward, but Charles Gore's tomb was actually over here, just out of sight. He was buried here, and there's a great Russian icon was painted on the spot there. And Walter Freer, the other great founding father of Merfield, his tomb is just over here. All of this has been swept away now by a new superior of advanced liturgical movement principles. I'm rather appalled at what he's done. I'm not going to show you what he's done. But anyway, this is where I worshipped for 3 years. And so Gore, like many great founding geniuses and proclaimers of community life, never actually got to live in the community of the Resurrection Merfield, but it was good for others, he felt. We'll come back to that later on. Well, at the age of 40, he decided to try something else. He decided to become the Vicar of Radley in 1893. It's a village just 5 miles outside Oxford, not too far away from the university, but he thought he really ought to try becoming the vicar. Here's the vicarage at Radley, and the early founding fathers of the Society of the Resurrection, as it's then called, are living with him. Well, I'm sorry to say that being a parish priest didn't suit Charles Gore. He worried about everything. As I say, don't sweat the small stuff, and you won't survive very long as a vicar if you do. Charles Gore agonised over everything. He was always wanting to get people to live to the best, the highest standard, and of course people ain't like that in the countryside so much. And he worried and agonised, and he wrote a long letter to Bishop Paget of Oxford, pouring out his all his troubles and asking for advice. And Bishop Paget wrote back to him a very brief one-sentence reply, "My dear Gore, don't be a bore." Well, Charles Gore had realised within a year that vicaring was not for him. And to the rescue came an offer to become a canon of Westminster Abbey. And this opened up a decade of very happy life for him, because now he was free to do what he was really good at: preach, teach, lead retreats, write books, inspire. And he was right there in the capital with people of influence and bright sparks. And it's worth thinking, in these years, one of his fellow canons at Westminster Abbey is Hensley Henson. Now, why is he important? This peppery young man was completely different to Gore in background. He'd fought his way up from the bottom into the middle class. He was a liberal and a broad churchman. He said that he believed in the creed ex animo. In other words, I accept the general thrust of the creed, where it's going to. I accept its vital importance as a symbol of Christian belief, but I am free to disagree on the details, such as the virgin birth, or whether the bones of Jesus still lie in Palestine. Although they were utterly different, and although Gore would later absolutely flat out oppose Hensley being made the Bishop of Durham, they did have a reasonably cordial relationship. Gore was, and he is a lovable creature, though I must admit that I fear every time I pick up a copy of the Times as to what he might have written about me in it. And Henson really represents another strand of the dynamism of the Church of England in this time, because he will come into his own, his sarcastic, cutting tongue, becomes moderated as Bishop of Durham. He was humbled by the amount of opposition to become a bishop, and he was one of the best bishops that Durham's ever had. What he used to do was exercise his leadership through a dynamic ministry of letter writing, because there were no photocopiers in those days, so he used to keep a copy, you know, copy into this master ledger of everything he'd ever written. But they were worth receiving, those letters, and he was a theologian of some note. Well, what happens next is that in 1901, Gore himself is recommended to become the Bishop of Worcester. Oh, storm of opposition, Anglo-Catholics becoming bishops. What is going on here? But after the storm of controversy, I should add, by the way, that Gore himself was really shaken by the vehemence of the opposition to Lux Mundi. And although he stood his ground, it's said that he developed what's called a never-again complex. I will never put myself in this position again of getting so far ahead of the pack that I invite this kind of a reaction. Well, after all the dancing up and down, Gore is eventually consecrated as Bishop of Worcester in 1902. Already, you see, Anglo-Catholics are beginning to move into the commanding heights of the Church of England. But Gore immediately saw the problem with the Diocese of Worcester, as indeed this problem existed right across the Church of England. The Church of England had been left with the great medieval diocese, huge diocese, very difficult to administer, where the centre of gravity was away from the major cities now developing through the Industrial Revolution. In that sense, the Roman Catholic Church had been left in a much better position when it first reformed its diocese in the middle of the 19th century, because it was free to locate itself in the centres of developing industrial civilization. And Gore could see right away that one of the problems is that he needed to split the diocese. And so he created the Diocese of Birmingham. And let's recall, Birmingham is the second biggest city in Britain. It was then, you know, one of the industrial centres. And so Gore, although he rather despised administration, did it very well. And he said, right, we're going to form this new diocese. There's no cathedral, so this neoclassical church of St Philip's in the middle of Birmingham will declare that to be the cathedral. There's no money for a bishop, so I will give away my patrimony of £10,000 to set up an endowment to fund future bishops of Birmingham. We just did it like that. Remember, he's a guy who didn't need much to run personally. And he was a great success, to everybody's surprise, as Bishop of Birmingham. Birmingham was renowned as the centre of what they called non-conformity. In other words, the Anglican Church was weak and the free churches were strong. But the people of Birmingham rather respected him because his abounding theological scholarship and his kind of prophetic earnestness and freedom meant that his radical zeal in politics and his prophetic moralism won the respect of a largely non-conformist city and diocese. The people of Birmingham voluntarily contributed to the money to build the statue to him after he left the Birmingham diocese. It's really the largest kind of memorial to him anywhere in Britain now. And then, having made a rather success of being Bishop of Birmingham, a fateful decision was made by others and by him. In 1911, he was offered the bishopric of Oxford, and he accepted. And this created the unhappiest time in his life. How was that? The Diocese of Oxford was and is very big indeed. It consists of hundreds of parishes. No one priest bishop could dominate. Well, Samuel Wilberforce had as compulsive overworker. It was said that in the Diocese of Birmingham, Gore overworked, in the Diocese of Oxford, he overworried. And Cosmo Gordon Lang, the Anglo-Catholic Archbishop of York, prophesied about him. He said, now that his freedom as a prophet and his love of outstanding theological scholarship has been taken away from him, the petulance and testiness of his character and personality will emerge. And that's exactly what happened. Yeah, so he becomes the Bishop of Oxford in 1911. In 1914, he writes an open letter to the clergy of the Diocese of Oxford, denouncing modernism and Romanism. He is now at war with his own Anglo-Catholics. Why is that? He disapproves of Anglo-Catholic clergy who have benediction. Do you know what I mean by that?
Mm-hmm.
At the end of evening prayer, you take the Blessed Sacrament, which you clipped into a thing like a demonstrance, mm-hmm. and you lift it up and you bless the people with it, mm-hmm. Which is a clear contradiction of one of the 39 articles, which says the sacrament of the altar was never intended to be carried about, lifted up, or whatever. I've got the exact words. Mm-hmm. He also disapproved of extreme Anglo-Catholics who were Anglo-Papalists, that is to say, those who were working for reunion with Rome on Rome's terms and to accept the leadership of the Bishop of Rome of the Western Church. So it is said that after this letter, he poured out his wrath on the modernizers and the Romanizers. The modernists answered back, the Romanizers carried on, and Davidson, the Archbishop of Canterbury at Lambeth, will be coming to very soon, temporized. He was one of those very smooth managing individuals who always managed to put off a crisis by saying it was a storm in a teacup and encouraging everybody to calm down. Here's what being Bishop of Oxford did to Gore. He is not looking like a happy man, is he? Perhaps it's him in an earlier mood, more relaxed mood. And here we have Randall Davidson, Archbishop of Canterbury for many years, Scottish in origin, the man who thought that chats with chaps in the corridors of power will manage just about anything, prided himself on his ability to manage relations with Parliament, prided himself on his ability to handle hotheads. And it said, when Gore came down the front steps of Lambeth Palace, having been manoeuvred out of some demand for discipline, he would say to himself, he hopelessly told friends, "Now, Charles, you never meant to agree to that." And once walking back over Lambeth Bridge, he turned and impotently shook his fist towards the wily Archbishop's study. Now, Randall Davidson, in a sense, in the end, met his own apotheosis and his own nemesis. Having smoothly managed the Church of England for several decades, he probably made a mistake in deciding not to retire in 1923, and he went on to lead the Church of England into the great disaster of the 1928 attempt at prayer book revision. You see, Davidson could never understand why people got hot under the collar about something and got really fired up about it. Why did the Anglo-Catholics want a revising of the prayer book, which added an invocation of the Holy Spirit, and to remove Cranmer's truncation of the Eucharistic prayer? Well, Walter Freer, back at Murfield, and other liturgiologists kept on working steadily through the decade and produced a new version of the BCP. It wasn't just Anglo-Catholics. Padres at the front had pointed out that the BCP wasn't terribly good. We needed shorter services when there were shells whistling overhead and I'm celebrating Holy Communion. There'd been a head of steam about prayer book revision. And finally, after years of difficulty, here it was in draft form. But the problem is, since we're established, it has to go to Parliament for their approval. The problem is that Parliament has Scottish Presbyterians in it and Northern Ireland Proto-Pacifists and other people who don't believe in God, and they are allowed to vote on it. And guess what happened? The Protestant associations whipped up opposition and the 1928 prayer book was turned down. The Church of England hastily sent it back to the revisers, who made a few small cosmetic changes, and Parliament turned it down again. A huge crisis. In the end, what the Church of England bishops did was to publish the 1928 prayer book with a preface saying, this book is not authorised for use, but you may choose to use it in your parish. And there was we're saying, we won't prosecute you for it. But for Davidson, this was a great humiliation. Right. In 1914, Gore, in his unhappiness at Oxford, was taking a student mission in the Unity Church, and he broke down in tears in the vestry afterwards, just as a sign of how much the job had got to him. But he stuck it out until 1919, when he retired, resigned as Bishop of Oxford, and he said, don't offer me another job. I will not be attending the Lambeth Conference that's about to come up. I will forge my own future now, thanks very much. I've had enough of doing what the Church of England wants me to do. And what is now ushered in is the happiest time, here is the older Charles Gore, from 1919 to 1933 when he dies. He's back in London, doing what he does best. Write books, preach, teach, inspire. It was a mystery to me. Well, where did Gore hang out during these years? Having lunch with Father Carl last week, the answer became clear. He lived in the clergy house at All Saints Margaret Street, and Father Carl was made to live in his room as the curate of All Saints Margaret Street. Very uncomfortable it was too, apparently. Shared communal bathroom, lots of noise from the street from the City of London. But under about the 1920s, it was a clip-clop of horse hooves outside rather than the roaring of the internal combustion engine. So, this is the greatest period of Gore's life. What is his significance and what did he stand for? He was a moralist. I don't mean that in the bad sense that we usually think of a moralist. I mean that in the sense that he had a series of lectures, the Gifford lectures, towards the end of his life about the good life. He believed that God has made available to us from the high standard, the high ethical standard that he calls us to live, the avenue to the good life. He was particularly struck by prophetic religion. Where were this amazing call for the Jewish nation, both individually and collectively, to live out this splendid life come from? It must have come from God. They wouldn't have thought this up themselves. To kind of lift their game so high. And in that sense, he wished the people of God also to be invigorated in like manner and to receive this as the various commands of God for good living. And in a sense, Anglo-Catholicism in the years after him, as it lost that prophetic moralism, would become a little bit decadent. Rather too interested in ceremonial and in-house gains, really. The other thing about Gore, he paved the way for the Church of Anglo-Catholicism to advance into the corridors of power. Because what happened after? His Cosmo Gordon Lang moved from becoming Archbishop of York to become Archbishop of Canterbury after Randall Davidson. You know, he's the man who's there on the spot to manage the abdication crisis. Now, Lang had his faults. He was vain. Was Hensley Henson once said, if there were a bunch of bishops who were walking past a portrait that had been recently painted of Cosmo Gordon Lang in Lambeth Palace, and Lang said rather sadly, And critics say this makes it pompous, proud and prolific, to which Henson said, to which of those epithets does your lordship take exception? but he was nevertheless a very good manager of the Church of England, and this was a sign that Anglo-Catholicism was now no longer an opposed minority movement. It had moved to centre stream. This man, Arthur Michael Ramsay, who will become Bishop of Durham, Archbishop of Canterbury, will be there at the crowning of Queen Elizabeth in the early 1950s, will be the Archbishop of Canterbury in the 1960s and the early 1970s, saw himself as the direct descendant, the inheritor of Gore, really. In fact, one of his books was called From Gore to Temple. And many of the finest things that Gore had said in his theology come to full fruition in the inspiring leadership of Michael Ramsay, who was a Catholic in the widest, broadest and deepest sense. He was the man who pushed for Anglican Methodist reunion and had his heart broken. It was turned down by the General Synod, fiercely opposed by conservative evangelicals and Anglo-Catholics. And I'm very tempted to give a talk about him next year as really one of the finest of Anglo-Catholics of the 20th century. And this man, Robert Runcie, Archbishop of Canterbury through the 1980s and the early 1990s. In a sense, it's the high watertide mark and the last gasp of liberal Anglo-Catholicism is exemplified in Runcie's leadership. Now, the way the Church of England does it, it's turn and turn about. The Anglo-Catholics had their turn last time, now it's the evangelicals' turn. So it's Donald Coggan who stands the evangelical between Ramsay and Runcie, followed by Lord Carey after Robert Runcie and then Rowan Williams. So Gore had helped the movement to come into the very centre of things. The Church of England at this time was trying to recover its own independence, recover control of itself. This, after all, had been a thing that Anglo-Catholics had pressed for, but many other people. And it did this through the Life and Liberty movement, where it tried to re-establish its own, what we would call diocesan synods and general synods. And Gore said, those who will be on those representative bodies ought to be confirmed and communicants. And one famous saying, he said, Well, he made the point that no club or society allows people to make important decisions about its life unless they've paid up their dues and they're contributing in an effective way. He was turned down because the old idea of the nation at prayer still survived. It was, you know, Gore wanted a, he saw the church, as Anglo-Catholics tended to do, as a supernatural society distinct from civil society. He wanted it to have standards, discipline, a societo perfecto. As one person said, he believed in that the church is more represented by, you know, the 12 apostles and the 70, you know, the wider circle of those who followed Jesus, some of whom fell away. Well, in the end, the rules were that you could be on those bodies, providing that you lived in your parish, you had been baptised, and you turned up at church every now and then. It was the old, inclusive, tolerant thing. Gore was furious. The other thing he got into a major clash with was the idea about what freedom of belief should be permitted Anglicans. Gore believed that the clergy needed to believe and teach the faith of the creeds, the Nicene Creed and the others. They were not free to believe ex animo as Hinckley Henson did. They could disagree about the conclusions of New Testament scholarship. They could accept that critical scholarship might test and probe central doctrines of orthodoxy, but in the end they would teach the orthodox Christian faith. Laity were free to believe, have much wider latitude. And on the whole, the church declined to accept that, with certain difficulties that would come on in later decades as scholarship became more and more sceptical. So, for instance, when I was in Britain, there were people who saw themselves as Anglo-Catholics with extremely sceptical conclusions about New Testament scholarship. And as I made clear in those articles in The Rock last year, that created its own problems, an overly sceptical scholarship that let down the church's teaching authority. Well, Perhaps Gore's most important contribution is this, and the way he defined Anglicanism. I'm going to finish with this. I find that in her history, in many of its aspects and characteristics, it makes me feel ashamed and depressed. But if there is in history the stamp of a divine providence on any society, it is set on the Anglican Church. It was marked out in the 16th century to hold together the ancient Catholic tradition, both in creed and order. With the appeal of the Reformation to the open Bible as the final court of reference for Christians, and so to present a type of Catholicism which the world had forgotten, which should have priests but not be priest-ridden, and should accept the Catholic tradition but keep it purged by the free use of reason and an all-pervading scripturalness. And you know, from Gore, when he thought about what priests do and who they are, he didn't just see them as kind of vicarious representatives of God, as Roman Catholics tended to do. He would say that the priest is also the representative of the congregation. When St. Peter's Cavisham gathers together in that church on Sunday morning, it is all of you who are celebrating the Eucharist, all of you who are bringing the sacrifice of the Mass before God. The priest is the kind of representative of you all. He's also the representative of God in that dialogical rhythm between God and the people. But the people themselves are the ones who celebrate it. And that's why Anglicanism always licenses a priest to a particular ministry or a particular parish, and you're not just ordained into nothing, as though you just collected, you know, sitting on top of the cornflakes packet. You must be ordained into a particular ministry, to a particular group of people, because you represent them. So, an inspiring individual. I really haven't got across the way in which he was such a prophet, he made so many people feel that the Christian life could be attempted in a rather more adventurous way. And here's some final summings up about him. No self-respecting society from a nation or a church down to a debating society can be asked to allow a right of control to belong to persons who are not showing their allegiance to the principle of the society by the performance of their spiritual duties. Yes. Right. Hensley Hansen, his great opponent, said this: I judge him to have been the most considerable English churchman of his time, not the most learned, not the most eloquent, but so learned, so eloquent, so versatile and so energetic that he touched the life of this generation at more points and more effectively than any of his contemporaries. H.D.A. Major, one of the major liberals and modern church of the 1920s, who certainly rejected Gore's theological conclusions. Few men during the last 50 years have done more than he to mould the character and policy of the Church of England. He also said, she who had been aptly described as the Conservative Party of Prayer came as a result of Gore's influence, at least in persons of her Anglo-Catholic clergy, the Socialist Party at Mass. William Temple, Archbishop of Canterbury in the Second World War, said, though I've had many tutors in Christ, he was perhaps above all my father. And so far as I can picture Jesus Christ, I picture him as not unlike the Father whom I have lost. And Michael Ramsey said, Gore's personality was absolutely overwhelming, and as that of someone who seemed to be righteousness embodied. Okay, that's it. Now, we pause now and resume these lectures in November, beginning with David Hoskins, who will be talking about the influence of organists and choir and music directors at St. Peter's Cavisham as agents of cultural enlightenment in South Dunedin. Mm-hmm. Then a lecture by Professor John Stenhouse from the Otago History Department will be talking about the social impact of South Dunedin's churches, how they had a very considerable influence on the suburb, and how the calumny spread by the guy who wrote the Cavisham, what's it now, Building the New Future, Cavisham 1880 to 1920, who argued that working class people didn't go to church, how wrong that was. And finally, David Howard, this year's Burns Fellow in Literature, we're talking about poetry. Now next year I propose to give a series of papers on outstanding and colourful Anglo-Catholic personalities of the 20th century. We'll be talking about people like Conrad Knoll, the vicar of Thaxter, had his parishioners doing maypole dances around a maypole on the village common. And people like Ninian Comper, the architect, and Don Gregory Dix, the monk of Nashton, who was the great pioneer of liturgical studies, and Arthur Michael Ramsay, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Thank you for your attention. We're now open to lectures and questions. Questions and points.
Just a quick one. Thank you very much. Now, Reverend or Mr. Gore, you called him a prophet as well. How did you quite get that picture of him?
He pushed the Church of England in the direction of being very interested in social questions, political questions, and areas of reform, and certainly away from being in collusion with the establishment ruling circles. He wanted the Church to be a distinct society and not just merged in with general civil population. The Oxford movement itself had pushed disestablishmentarianism. In other words, it wanted to see the Church of England break its connection with the state. That didn't happen. But the critique of it all pushed the Church of England towards resuming control of its own affairs. He wanted the Church of England and its members to live to a far higher standard than it had before. I think that sense of prophetic moralism really meant something. Mm-hmm. He wanted a more disciplined church, and that's been one of the themes, I think, throughout these lectures, that one of the challenges that Anglicanism has failed to respond to is to get its members to face up to their spiritual responsibilities and duties, and to live a life that looks outstandingly different to those around them. And that's, you know, as a founder of a religious community, that was an attempt to recover those. Because, you know, people who live in religious communities are saying, what matters most is the kingdom of God, more than, you know, paying off a mortgage and just blending in. And
so he actually did that through his personal life, where he gave up. Did you say something about that?
He gave away most of his money to fund the Bishopric of Birmingham.
Amazing.
He lived off the son of Naughty Rag, although he had very expensive tastes. Yes.
Of course, he was single.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think Catholicism was very, seems to have been general in Britain during the time of these archbishops you've been talking about. It doesn't seem to be accepted here in New Zealand to the same extent.
I wrote my thesis about this in the Diocese of Christchurch. The problem was the Anglican Church that came to these islands in the 19th century had kind of been cut off from what was happening in the Church of England. People got on with building their lives, establishing a local parish church. When in the 1870s in New Zealand, clergy come out from England and they start creating changes in worship and liturgy, the laity is startled. Where did this come from? How did this happen? We haven't heard about this. Mm-hmm. There was a kind of catch-up exercise going on all the time. And the first attempts to establish the second generation, the second wave of Anglo-Catholicism in New Zealand were fiercely opposed right up to the early 20th century. And the first major change points is that the Church of the Good Shepherd Phillipstown in Christchurch, it sneaks in because the architect Benjamin Mountford kind of built the church, took it over, and bossed the new vicar, who was a former Methodist, into starting to behave like that. And a dynamic mission priest turns up at St. Michael's around 1910 and just overnight changed the society church in the middle of Christchurch. He was prepared to take all the flack and see half the congregation leave and bring another congregation in. Changed everything in 4 years and then left. So we were one generation behind and out of step. But the same problem came with accepting, say, Darwin's theory of evolution, biblical criticism. There was opposition to all that, and a problem that the Anglican Church in this country was always under-equipped to try to make itself a theologically reflecting community. The history of St. John's Auckland is a stormy petrel history of principles being sacked and moved on, of the college lurching from crisis to crisis. College House did better in terms of its continuity, but it had more difficulty in acquiring resources to kind of catch up with all that had been happening in Europe and Britain in those decades before. So we tended to be a bit behind. Well, I think a catch-up had certainly occurred by the mid-20th century.
Mm. Yeah. It just seems that Protestantism seems to influence the Anglican Church a lot.
I think that what happened with a kind of functional evangelicalism had a major influence on the development of Anglican religion in this country.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't highly developed or articulated in a theological sense. Evangelicals in the Church of England tended to be more sophisticated,
mm-hmm.
But it also, of course, was easier to get going in some ways in the early years. Methodism, for instance, ran rings around Anglicanism in the first decades of colonial society in New Zealand because it was every member ministry, as they say. You know, laity were highly trained to get on with the responsibilities of running a parish and evangelising people.
Mm-hmm.
Later, by sheer mass, the big battalions began to overshadow the Methodists and they had their own problems.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's part of the answer.
Mm-hmm.
In Dunedin, it was different. I think that for a long time, this diocese tended to be a more tractarian to middle of the road to slightly high diocese as a reaction against the great surrounding sea of Presbyterianism.
Mm-hmm.
It was a way of saying, this is who we are.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, I'm thinking of our own parish, really. When I came to Dunedin, it was very like your church, your parish, but it's gradually become quite a very low church.
Except on Christmas Eve and Easter Day.
Only because you're there.
Well, you could argue, I mean, I think up until, what was his name now? But
Harold Harding.
The bishop just before Peter Jameson.
Oh, yes.
Peter Mann.
Yes.
Yes.
All of that which I've been speaking
right.
was true about the Diocese of Dunedin up to then. And it was a generation of priests, Father Harding,
absolutely.
Father Charles Harrison,
yes.
who set a standard, really.
Absolutely.
All of this stuff comes to its high point. It would be a fascinating thesis or book to write about that generation and what happened here
mm.
in that time. Mm. You know, there was John Teal here and what have you.
Right.
And several other priests with that.
Mm.
When Penny Jameson was elected as the Bishop of Dunedin, I think there was a desire to say, we've become different now. We're not fuddy-duddy conservatives anymore. We've become progressive Anglicans.
Mm.
And a new dynamic was unleashed that nobody foresaw the end results of, and which is now fully rolled out.
Mm. Mm. Mm.
Discreet silence would cover it, yes. But for a while, in the 40s and 50s, Dunedin was something rather special and rather different.
Mm.
And that's what Father Carl looks back on in his childhood, you know.
He is. Mm. That's before my time.
Mm. Timothy Raphael, he was a Mayfield priest. He was a Dean of Dean briefly here.
That's right. He remember going to? Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, in Christchurch, St. Michael's is the one Anglo-Catholic church, isn't it?
He'd been the vicar of St. Michael's before he came here.
Yes, that's right. He had to.
Yes.
Mm.
His wife didn't like New Zealand. She wanted to go back, so an offer of going to become the vicar of St. John's Wood came into play and accepted it.
Mm-hmm.
Timothy Raphael used to tell a story that the nominators, the selectors, came out from John's Wood to check him out. And of course, in those days, telegrams were sent, and leading to this small society, Timothy Raphael's spies reported back to him what the telegram had been. It's all right, he's white. Thank you very much.
Thank you.